Hi, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Tell Me More. Dr. Fareed Razavi is a gastroenterologist who has a very, very impressive resume. He did his undergraduate work at the University of Pennsylvania, and he went on to New York Medical College, where he graduated with honors. He did his residency at, I'm not going to look at my notes, New York Presbyterian, right? And then fellowship at NYU. So, all that to say, he is an expert in his field, and I'm just so honored to have him. Fareed, welcome to my show.
So it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So nice. So, by the time you guys hear this, it's going to be the first week of March, and March is Colon Cancer Awareness Month. So, I'm just going to take a minute to remind people who may not know my personal story. I've always wanted to be a doctor since as long as I can remember. And I would say 99% of the reason for that is because of my aunt, Dr. Venus Fanous, who I grew up basically with, like literally alongside in her house when I was very young. She was in medical school, and I remember very clearly she had like human bones that she was studying, and she would let me like touch them and feel them. She is the most amazing, gifted physician in the world. To my dying breath, I will say that. Kind, compassionate, never ever tired of her work. But like most physicians, she did put herself last. Fareed and I were just talking about this. You have a little cold, Fareed, and like you're plowing through. So my aunt didn't get around to her routine colonoscopy at the time. The age was 50. It was recommended at 50, and she didn't quite get to it because she was taking care of everybody else. And when she was 59, she was diagnosed with stage 3B colon cancer. She woke up one day with like just severe pain, and had had a colon perforation because of this malignant mass in her colon. And so I know I'm getting emotional just talking about it because, for so many reasons, but this is not about me. But anyway, she's great now. She had surgery. She went through chemo. This was in 2012. So she's past her 10-year anniversary, cancer-free. She's back to work. She's doing everything. I know. And Fareed, you'll tell us like that's not like a common story
No,
for an advanced stage colon cancer, right?
that's a great story. I'm so happy that she's doing well, and it's a testament to modern medical care. But that story, that presentation of your aunt is very unusual. To present with severe abdominal pain, perforation, peritonitis is really, really unusual. And that sort of goes to the fact colon cancer is silent for most people until it's very advanced. People think they have to have a symptom like bleeding or bloating or cramping or a change in bowel habits, when in fact, polyps grow and lead to colon cancer over many, many years quite slowly. And that's the sort of underscores the importance of screening tests. And that's the definition of a screening test. A screening test is one in which you get it done to prevent the cancer, whether it's breast cancer, prostate cancer, colon cancer. In this case, you do it when you're well, not when you have symptoms. Because if you're doing it when you have symptoms, obviously it becomes a diagnostic test. And that's fine. We do those as well. But we're talking about screening today, and screening happens in healthy people. But yeah, so, people don't realize this, but or maybe some people do, but most people don't realize colon cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death in the world, only second to lung cancer. It's really, really common. All of us know. I have a cousin who has colon cancer at 45. I both mother and father with polyps. I have polyps, maybe TMI, but just FYI, I mean, I have polyps. 41 when I had my first colonoscopy, and I had four polyps. It's really important to understand that nobody really looks forward to a colonoscopy, but you have to reframe what a colonoscopy is. There's a 90% survival rate after you have a colonoscopy, you detect colon cancer or colon polyps early, 70% reduction in mortality with colonoscopy. So think about it like a fantastic nap with a little urge beforehand, but it really isn't that bad of a test. And it's a great prevention and detection test. So I strongly suggest anybody within cancer screening age, and we'll get into that in more detail, to really think about it that way. You know, it's a very small price to pay, one day out of work doing a bowel prep, to have a 70% reduction in mortality from totally, totally preventable cancer.
Yeah.
So the key is early detection and removal of precancerous lesions, which are polyps.
So let's talk about that a little bit. So I hear this a lot in my practice where patients will be like, I'm fine, I feel fine. So you address that, like most people with, you know, early colon cancer or precancerous polyps don't feel anything and just think everything's fine. And I would even argue that if you're having a symptom because of your colon cancer, man, it's a little late. Like you really should have done something a long time ago.
It's concerning. Yeah.
So that's the first thing I hear is I feel fine. The other thing I hear a lot is I don't have a family history. Can you speak to that, Fried? Like what percentage of people with colon cancer actually have a history, a family history of colon cancer?
Yeah, so the vast majority of folks are sporadic, meaning that they're the first person in their family to have colon cancer. Maybe there's a family history of polyps, but in the vast majority of folks, it's not a hereditary syndrome. It is a sporadic occurrence. So just because you don't have a family history doesn't mean that you're not prone to colon cancer.
Right.
We know that to be true from multiple longitudinal nursing studies. If you do have a family history of polyps or colon cancer, your increased risk is 2 to 4-fold. So something to pay attention to. And if you do have a family history, you should start screening 10 years before the first pre-reflected relative. So if your mother, for example, had colon cancer at 50, you would start screening at 40. Or if she had it, let's say, even really at 45, very young, you should start at 35. So 10 years younger than the first degree affected relative. Mm-hmm. It's that important to keep on top of. So people shouldn't be complacent because they don't have a family history. And unfortunately, in our younger population, those people between 45 and 50, and even younger than that, we're seeing the rates of colon cancer spike. It has a lot.
Why do you think that is? Do you any thoughts about that?
I don't think anyone's been able to say with absolute certainty, but you don't see generational changes in genetics. You do see generational changes in lifestyle. So we do think the obesity epidemic, we think that processed foods are the big culprits. So there is a quadruple risk of rectal cancer. It's a form of colorectal cancer down near the end of the colon. In young folks, quadruple risk, 4 times risk in someone born in 1990 compared to someone born around 1950.
Oh my goodness.
Same is true, about double the risk for proximal colon cancer or higher up colon cancer in folks who are younger compared to folks who are in the baby boomer generation or even generation for that exam. That a lot of that has to do with the fact that people over 50 are doing a better job of getting screened historically, getting screening tests. Whereas younger folks are not, and that's why we dropped the guidelines of cancer. American Cancer Society, American College of Gastroenterology have dropped the screening age to 45 as a result of that. So,
let's talk about that too for a second. So, but I want to back up a little bit. So, colon cancer appears to be more common now in younger people than it used to be. I know very clearly when I was in training, cancer was like a disease that old people got, like period. Yeah. Like, and although my perspective then is probably that a 50-year-old was old. I have a very different perspective now. But so as you said, as a result, the guidelines have changed. So now it is recommended that your average risk person have their first colonoscopy at age 45, average risk.
Average risk.
People who are at higher risk have it, like you said, 10 years before their first degree family member is diagnosed, right?
Exactly.
What about people who have inflammatory bowel disease, like ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. People with active ulcerative colitis or Crohn's colitis, Crohn's disease affecting the colon, are at substantially increased risk of colon cancer. They have an 8-fold or 8 times risk of colon cancer than the average person. Mm. Now, if those folks are in remission and their insides are not inflamed, they're doing great, they're on the right medication, their risk drops back down to close to average. Mm-hmm. For people who've had the diagnosis, let's say of ulcerative colitis or Crohn's colitis for at least 8 years, they're getting surveillance colonoscopies every year or two. They are not average risk. Some might argue that if they're under great control, they can go back towards an average risk screening protocol, but the majority of those folks are going to be screened a lot more often or surveyed a lot more often because people with colitis have a different pathway to colon cancer. People with inflammatory bowel disease tend to develop flatter lesions that spread much faster than, let's say, an average person with a polyp, for example. So it's important that we biopsy those folks every few centimeters in the colon throughout, even if it looks normal, to look for any precancerous or what we call dysplastic tissue. So they're monitored much more closely. So for example, if someone's diagnosed with ulcerative colitis when they're 18, 8 years later, the 26, they're starting to get yearly or every other yearly surveillance colonoscopies.
Wow. So I think it is important, one, to identify like which type of patient are you? And most people are going to be average risk patients. And if there's any question in your mind as a patient of when you should be screened, you should talk to your doctor about it, obviously. So I want to dig into the colonoscopy very, very specifically for it. And then we'll get into some of the other screening options. But I like to think of a colonoscopy as, obviously, it's the gold standard. But, you know, it is, like you alluded to, it's more than just a screening test. It is a preventative test. And perhaps it is, I can't think off the top of my head right now, but I would say it's probably the only true cancer preventative test, in that if you see a polyp and you remove a polyp, that polyp doesn't become cancer. Whereas like in a mammogram, you may see a cluster of calcifications, but you can't exactly do something about it in that moment, right? So the colonoscopy is so, it serves those, you know, very, very critical purposes of looking, seeing, but also removing. So let's talk about the actual procedure, because I think a lot of hesitancy and fear comes from lack of understanding, right? So walk me through it. What, tell me from start to finish. Okay, I'm 45, Dr. Razavi. I'm going to schedule my colonoscopy. Tell me what happens.
Yeah. So speaking from the point of view of a patient and a physician who does this all day, most days, it's a very straightforward test, and it's really not bad at all. I think most people overestimate how harsh the bowel prep is.
Yeah.
I don't think it's that bad. I think we can talk about some strategies later in the conversation about how to deal with the bowel prep. But here's how it goes. You say, okay, it's time for you to have an average risk screening colonoscopy. You're going to pick out a date that works for you. Typically a weekday, you can get off work. You are going to have someone with you because you're going to be sedated for the procedure. And it's a wonderful sedation, as everyone knows. We use drugs. Well, and anyone who's had a colonoscopy is going to smile and understand it's a fantastic nap. The responsible person to drive you home. There are specific recommendations for diet a few days before. So you've scheduled your procedure on a Friday, let's say. About 5 days before that, you want to be on a low residue diet or a low fiber diet to prevent things from getting hung up in your colon, because we want to be able to see everything on the inside. The better view we get, the better chance we get of removing every, seeing every polyp and removing every polyp. It's the crux of the test. So low fiber diet. And then the day before the procedure, you're going to have a low fiber breakfast, some eggs, for example, a nice little light omelet, and then clear liquids throughout the day until about 6 o'clock, when you start your bowel prep, which is usually polyethylene glycol in most cases, or Miralax, it's the most common trade name. And we usually have people mix that with Gatorade, about 32 ounces. We do a split dose bowel prep where you do the first dose over 2-3 hours the night before, and the second dose about 5-6 hours before the procedure, in the early morning before the procedure. So it's about 64 ounces of bowel prep total. So not a crazy volume. It's not the most delicious substance, but it's totally doable. And we ask people to hydrate throughout the day, because the bowel prep can be a little bit dehydrating, not terribly dehydrating, but we want to make sure you're drinking water throughout, and clear liquids throughout as well. It's important that you don't drink, you know, red juice or purple juice to terrify us. We're doing the colonoscopy active hemorrhage while you're doing it. That can confuse us a little bit. But yeah, for 1 day, clear liquids. And then 4 hours before the procedure, you're going to stop all bowel prep, nothing by mouth, so that you reduce the risk of anything in your stomach when you're under anesthesia. And that's true for any type of surgery, any type of procedure, for safety reasons. And then you have the colonoscopy. You show up at your center, wherever that endoscopy center is. You'll be greeted by the nurses. You'll walk back. You'll get an IV for sedation. All right. And then you'll get a little oxygen in your nose, which smells like a beach ball, a little bit of a garden smell. And that's just for safety. And then we get a consent. We talk about the procedure. We go through all the details, straightforward. And the procedure itself is about 15 to 20 minutes. And the way it works is we give you a lovely medication called propofol. It's an amazing, amazing nap. You fall asleep right away. And then you wake up right when it's done. Very, very minimal hangover effect. You'll feel great within 5 minutes of waking up. And the procedure itself, what I'm doing is I'm going into the colon with a colonoscope, which is about 9-10 millimeters in diameter, a little bigger than the average finger, not that big at all. And we go all the way to the end of the colon and all the way out. On the way out, we do our examination. We go all the way to the end, which is called the cecum, which is the last part of the colon where it connects to the small intestine. And we very slowly come out and look at every crevice and nook of the colon, looking for any precancerous polyps. And if we see them, like you said, right there and then, it's a one-step procedure. We're preventing, detecting and preventing colon cancer by taking out the precursor lesions to colon cancer. So colon cancers come from polyps. We call them adenomatous polyps or sessile serrated polyps. There's two flavors. The majority of cancers come from adenomatous polyps. Either way, we see a polyp regardless. Doesn't matter how big it is, how small it is, we take it out there and then, thereby preventing colon cancer in its tracks. And we come out, usually about 8 minutes coming out. The minimum is 6 minutes. And that's that. And then you wake up. We talk to you about the results. We can tell you with fairly good confidence what we saw and what we believe the pathology to be. So when we say pathology, we take that polyp, we put it into formalin, we preserve it, and we send it to a specialized doctor who looks at it under a microscope, a pathologist, tells us, is this cancerous? Is this precancerous? Most gastroenterologists have been doing this for a number of years. We can tell visually based on the size, based on the way the polyp looks, if we're concerned or not. So we can give you a good sense for that right there and then. And then we'll call you a few days later with an update on the pathology, and we'll give you a surveillance interval. So for example, if you have three polyps or more, regardless of size, we're going to say come back in 3 years. That's unfortunately or fortunately the interval that I'm on personally. If you have one to two polyps, it's going to be 5 years. Okay. If you have no polyps and your average risk, meaning you have no family history, nor do you have a history of colitis or Crohn's disease, it's going to be 10 years for screening colonoscopy. So you get a nice little reprieve there. That's basically colonoscopy in a nutshell. And you can go back to work the next day. The day you've had your colonoscopy, you really shouldn't, you should not be driving, absolutely not be driving, no alcohol, no major life decisions, relaxing, Netflix, relax on the couch, do nothing, put your feet up. And yeah, the next day you can totally go back to work regardless of what you do. So
amazing. So that was such a great, you know, walkthrough. And I'm glad you addressed the prep because that's a very common thing. Like, oh, I just hate the prep.
Yeah.
It's not a picnic by any means. And the goal of the prep is to empty your gut out. So yes, it is unpleasant, but it needs to be done. And it's literally like a few hours of your life, right?
Yeah.
I want to ask you some very specific questions for you. So, you know, our patients are more and more sophisticated and have access to so much information. And one of the things that I'm surprised about, or not as much anymore, but I was surprised the first time a patient asked me about it, is this idea that not all colonoscopists are created equal, right? So we usually say, like, go get a colonoscopy. It's like, go pick up a sandwich. It's not that simple, right? So the two things that I think patients may need to or want to know about are, one, how good the colonoscopist is in terms of their ability to detect a polyp. So there's a metric for that, right?
Yeah,
can you talk
absolutely.
About that?
That's a fantastic question, Christine. And that's really not talked about enough. That's a really savvy patients asking those questions. And I praise them for doing so because you're right. Not every colonoscopist is created equal. We like to think so. And there are metrics that we judge ourselves by. So what you're referring to is something called the adenoma detection rate or the polyp detection rate. And generally speaking, you want to be about 25 to 30% for men and women in terms of detecting that. So the denominator is all your screening colonoscopies. The numerator is the number of precancerous polyps you detect or adenomas. And generally speaking, if you ask most doctors, they'll tell you, I don't know that that's advertised anywhere. Over the last 3 years, our practice, US Digestive Health, we have kept track of that in all our doctors, and we have a very high adenoma detection rate, up to 45, 50% in some cases, which is really approaching the upper tier of adenoma detection rate. So we make sure of two things. The way you can ensure that you have a high adenoma detection rate, eyes on the screen at all time, obviously, but other eyes in the room. So I always tell my nurses, my medical assistants who are in the room assisting me, and there's always going to be people in the room assisting me. There's going to be a medical technician and a nurse anesthetist typically, or an anesthesiologist. I say, if you don't mind, could you watch the screen with me? So two pairs of eyes is great. Four pairs, six pairs of eyes, three pairs of eyes, I should say, is much better. So more eyes on the screen helps, and people will help point things out. Number one, taking your time, never rushing an examination. So adenoma detection rate is directly linked to how slowly and how methodically you withdraw the scope out of the colon. Mm-hmm. So that's why, you know, all of our societies suggest a 6-minute withdrawal time. We try and go above and beyond that and go slower and look for any polyps we can find. So that's extremely important metric, as is withdrawal time, as is the intubation rate, et cetera. The other thing that we found to be very helpful, specifically in our practice, U.S. Digestive Health partnered with Medtronic, and we have a first-in-class artificial intelligence unit attached to our scopes. It's really
that interesting.
Helps actually pinpoint polyps. I don't know if you've seen this before. It actually puts a little marker on the screen. It overlays the screen so that you can see really small polyps. And sometimes polyps aren't obvious. We have, you know, polyps come in all shapes and sizes. They can be large, polypoid, meaning they're like frond-like, like broccoli, where you can't miss it. And other times they can be very subtle and flat, like a little bit of a mucus layer on top. It's really, really subtle. And this artificial intelligence platform by Medtronic actually does a fantastic job of highlighting all sorts of shapes, sizes of polyps. So that's also increased our adenoma detection rate in our practice a lot, significantly. Mm-hmm. I don't have the exact number for you, Christine. I'll have to get back to you on that. But we actually did data on this at our last meeting, physicians meeting. It actually was substantial.
So, wow.
And that's something
I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because I think, you know, if you're going to do this test, right, you don't want to just do it and check the box. You want to do it and make sure that you got what you signed up for, so to speak. So let me just dig into that a tiny bit more for you. So, you know, if I'm understanding you right, this is a simple ratio, right? If you do, you know, 100 colonoscopies, you should detect about 25
at the minimum,
right?
At the minimum. Right? Yeah.
So what if you have a doctor that detected 75 polyps? That might not necessarily mean that's a great doctor, right?
75%, you mean? Like a 75%
adenoma detection rate?
I mean, that's a very, that's a person with a lot of polyps in their practice. They may have.
Or is there such a, is it possible that maybe things are being removed as polyps that maybe aren't polyps? Like, is there a way that you guys confirm that?
That's a great question. There's no way to really, I'm just trying to answer, understand your question. There's no way to game the system, so to speak. So what happens is the calculations based on histopathology. In other words, so as you know, there's benign polyps in the rectum. Lots of people have them called hyperplastic polyps, which do not increase your risk. So if patients are listening to this and they have their colonoscopy reports and they see they have hyperplastic polyps, those are not cancers. You should have a 10-year follow-up, your average risk. What we're really concerned about is adenomatous polyps or sessile serrated polyps. The calculation for the polyp detection rate comes from adenomatous polyps specifically. So
it's followed up on the pathology.
75% adenoma detection rate, you're an absolute beast in a good way. That's like the Mount Everest of gastroenterologists. That's amazing.
Oh my God. I love it. All right. That is a fantastic answer. Okay. So then the other, you know, not the flip side, but the other thing that patients always, always fear, because everybody's had a neighbor or friend that had a perforation after a colonoscopy.
Yeah.
So can you speak to that? What is the actual risk of that? And, you know, how do you guys work to prevent perforations?
That's the thing that everyone's obviously in the back of everyone's head. As a gastroenterologist, it's front of mind every time I do a colonoscopy.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the majority of the data looking at perforations, it comes down to a few things. Obviously, gastroenterologist skill, experience, and knowing sort of when not to push, right? Mm-hmm. It's very much operator dependent. The average rate across the country, all gastroenterologists, is about 4 perforations per 10,000-ish procedures.
Oh my God. Wow. Still, that's not a lot at all.
If you're one of those 4 people, that's, you know, enough, right? It's difficult to quantify what it means and how to, because there's so many reasons someone could perforate. For example, if someone comes in who's 90 years old, okay, who's a bit more frail, who's been having abdominal pain or diverticulitis, for example, which is inflammation of the little pouches of the colon wall, which most people have heard of, they're at a much higher risk of perforation naturally because their colon, as they age, is going to be thinner and they're going to have a predisposition with diverticulitis with these thin pouches in their lower part of the colon. So that's going to predispose them to a higher risk. Doesn't mean they're guaranteed to perforate by any stretch, but the higher risk. Personally, I take pride in going in very, very slowly, using very gentle pressure, and knowing where I can push and where I can't push. And I find it to be extremely safe. Yeah. So I think
just
respecting people's anatomy. And not rushing it. Never rushing it.
I think highlighting a couple of things you said. So again, I'm no mathematician, but 4 out of 10,000 is 0.0001%, right? At 0.0004%. It's such a small, small, small number.
Yeah.
But you're right. Like if you're that one person, like it's hard to forget, put it that way. And so can you say, you know, the colonoscopy skill is important, you know, being gentle, but I think also the patient, you know, who the patient is kind of impacts the potential risk for a perforation, right? So a 90-year-old, somebody that's had an inflamed colon. So I think patients asking those very important questions, like, am I at risk? Should I wait a little bit? And I think an excellent gastroenterologist would be the first person to tell you, like, you really shouldn't have this colonoscopy, or you should wait a little bit since this colon infection that you had before you have a colonoscopy. So the point is, the benefit of the colonoscopy and detecting those potentially precancerous polyps far, 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 far exceeds the risk of a perforation, right?
Yes, absolutely.
All right, so that's great. So let's then talk about the other things patients always want to know about. And I'm going to go through them just in the order that they're on the top of mind, not necessarily in the order of importance. Can you explain what a virtual colonoscopy is? What's a CT colonography?
Yeah, these are all great, great questions. Before I answer that, I want to go back to one thing I didn't talk about in terms of adenoma detection rate and the risk for complications like perforation. A good bowel prep is going to reduce both those risks.
Yes.
Your adenoma detection rate is only giving you as good as your bowel prep is good. And most doctors will stop the procedure and reschedule you if the bowel prep is inadequate, which is obviously everyone's worst nightmare to have to come back and do it again. It really is critical to do that bowel prep. And one simple pro tip here is that if you notice that you are getting nauseated while you're doing the bowel prep, press pause. You know, we have a lot of great patients who are box checkers who just have to do things exactly the way their doctor's laid out. And they're wonderful patients, but with a bowel prep, unfortunately, it's a one-size-fits-all approach. So everyone's gastric cavity is going to be different sized, right? So if you notice that you're feeling nauseated the night before in that first 32 ounces, and it's saying you have to drink, you know, all 32 ounces within, let's say, two, three hours, press pause. Drink it within 4 hours. Have some Sprite. Have some ginger ale. Calm yourself down. Just relax for a little bit, and then restart once you feel better. Because there's really no benefit to you marching through it and then vomiting up half the bowel prep.
Right.
So I tell most of my patients, so a good bowel prep is worth its weight in gold for detection and for reduction of, you know, harm.
Complications. Excellent point.
Going in. So I just wanted to mention that before we talked about CT colonography. So virtual colonoscopy or CT colonography is a two-step test, right? So we mentioned that screening colonoscopy is a one-step cancer detection prevention test. CT colonography is sort of the beginning of the realm of two-step tests. It's a CT scan that's been algorithmized in a way that looks at the colon. They use fecal tagging. I'm not going to get into details. It's not in my wheelhouse. I'm not a radiologist, obviously, but it's a CT scan for all intents and purposes that you do a bowel prep for. And then the radiologist will put a little bit of air or CO2 into your rectum, not a scope, but just a little bit of a spigot into there to inflate your colon. And they take a few snapshots and they're looking throughout the colon for polyps. So CT colonography is a test that I personally reserve for patients who have failed colonoscopies. For example, some colons, because of genetic defects, anatomical defects, or diverticulitis, are extremely torturous, or extremely twisty, such that we can't get the scope to go through without risking perforation. That's a great patient to have a CT colonography or virtual colonoscopy because there's no risk of that happening, twisting or perforating the colon. It's not as good as colonoscopy in the sense that it's not going to pick up flat lesions, right? So colonoscopy, you can see everything. And a CT scan, even if it's a three-dimensional CT scan, is very good for finding big, juicy polyps or tumors. When I say big, I mean usually bigger than 8 millimeters or a centimeter, and usually pedunculated, which is a style of polyp that looks like broccoli. You know, it's got a stalk and a bulge, and it looks very obvious, what we think of classically as a polyp. But it's not so great as those insidious right-sided of colon flat polyps. And that's where it has limitations. It's, you know, in a situation where you have no option, it's better to do that than nothing, obviously.
Right.
But that's sort of where it stands in my toolbox.
So I want to highlight a couple of things that you said. First of all, you don't skirt the prep when you opt for a CT colonoscopy.
No,
you still
got to
do the prep.
Yeah, you got to do the prep. So that, yeah.
I think that's a common misconception. Like, oh, I'll just do the virtual and then I have to don't have to do
it. And it's got a
prep.
Great name, virtual.
Yeah.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah, exactly. Sounds like nobody even has to touch me.
Right.
And then the other piece of it, you still have to have someone put a thing like where you don't want someone to put a thing. You're still getting a little, you know, that
and you're awake.
Stick it,
you're
you
awake
said.
For it. You're awake for it.
And you don't even get the juicy nap.
So, it's interesting. I think, you know, it's fallen out of favor over the last decade or so. It had a lot of promise, but the fact is it still can't detect those flat insidious lesions that are the most scary in the right side of the colon.
So then let's go all the way to the other end of the spectrum. And then I'm saving the thing that everybody wants to talk about for the last, but let's go all the way to fecal occult blood testing, little teeny tiny little card that you just got to put a smear of your feces on and you're done. Right. So can you talk about that? The limitations, pros, cons?
Sure. So fecal occult blood testing or GWIAC testing has been used forever. And that's sort of been the gold standard for decades and decades, obviously very sensitive for any blood, not very specific. And it picks up lots of things like hemorrhoids and all sorts of good stuff. So it doesn't guarantee anything, but it's a yearly test. And people have shifted towards fecal immunohistochemical testing or FIT testing as opposed to pure GWIAC testing, which is this little card. So FIT testing is much better than pure GWIAC testing. I'm not going to get into details of those assays, but FIT testing is what you guys use in your practice and what most people use as a non-invasive test. It's once a year, and it's just a detection test. Are we seeing blood? Are we not seeing blood? And that's it. It's not really telling us if there's any polyps, small, big, otherwise. It's just telling us if there's bloody polyps or cancer. So it is pretty much a cancer detection test. And it's quite good at detecting cancer because cancers typically bleed. Right. So if done yearly, which is, you know, the ideal interval, then it's pretty good. But again, never going to be able to detect polyps growing, so to speak.
Right.
Does that make sense? So it's this demarcation between cancer prevention, which I would say there's only one test, which is colonoscopy, and cancer detection, which is
right.
All the other non-invasive tests, including CT colonoscopy or virtual.
Right. So the advantages, I mean, from a patient perspective, I would say is you don't have to do a prep. You do this FIT test in the comfort of your own home. There's no sedation. You don't need somebody to drive you, all those things. The disadvantages.
The testing is also very cheap. It's like $25.
Oh, true. Right.
Compared to the other thing, which I'm sure you're going to bring up later, it's very cheap.
Yeah.
And I have nothing against any of these things. I think this is wonderful. I think, honestly, I want to make it clear, the best test is the one that gets done.
Yes, 100%.
Only 60% of people in the U.S. get screened for colon cancer. That's terrible.
Wow. That's terrible. Yeah,
with any modality.
Yeah.
So whatever we can do to increase the number of people getting screened, whether it's GWIAC testing, FIT testing, Cologuard testing, whatever, you know, virtual colonoscopies, capsule endoscopies, I don't care. If we're getting more people screened, we're doing better as a society. You know, it doesn't matter. We want to get them screened. So I'm a believer in the benefits of all tests. They're better than nothing, of course.
Right.
You know what I mean? So,
and they have a place. Everything has a place, right?
Yeah.
So the fit testing, though, you know, first of all, it detects blood. So in terms of colon cancer, you have to already have a colon cancer, presumably that's bleeding, for it to be.
Or you could have a hemorrhagic colon.
Right. Or you could have some other reason for, you know, blood to show up, like some totally unrelated thing, like you said, a little hemorrhoid, a little, you know, anal fissure, something like that. And, you know, people say like, well, you know, what's the problem with that? Well, if you've ever had a test be abnormal and have been terrified about it, that's the disadvantage. Now you have this positive test. You are terrified that you have colon cancer and you have to go through the process. You've got to wait now. You've got to go schedule the colonoscopy. And of course, like we all, you know, facilitate because now it's a diagnostic colonoscopy. Yes. It's going to get prioritized.
It's
but,
urgent.
You know, yeah. But that amount of time is so terrifying. You could have had a colonoscopy, done it from the beginning, had your screening and your prevention all in the same time. So there are advantages, but there are also some very notable disadvantages. So then let's get to the thing that, you know, the sexiest of all colon cancer detection modalities, the ColoGuard. I just want the box on my porch.
Yeah.
I'm just gonna leave it there and let
you talk about it. It's great marketing. I think it was SNL did a skit on ColoGuard. I don't know if you had a chance to watch that.
No, I'm going to now.
SNL ColoGuard. It's hilarious.
I'm on it.
Yeah, it's sort of become very much a popular test over the last few years. It's been out since, I think, 2014. It got FDA clearance. Again, it's like a flavor of fit. We've already talked about fit testing. What ColoGuard does really well is blood and genetic mutations that can lead to colon cancer, what we call KRAS mutations or oncogene mutations in the DNA that shed off a tumor.
Mm-hmm.
When it's a positive test, when you send that stool in the box and it comes back as positive, the company doesn't tell you whether it's positive because of blood in the stool from a hemorrhoid or because there's tumor change, you know, DNA changes that suggest a tumor.
Mm-hmm.
You're never told whether it's one or the other. It's just positive. ColoGuard is very good at detecting colon cancer. Like I said, very good at that, about 94% sensitivity. But if you look at those, that means still, you know, sometimes up to, I think some studies suggest 8% of colon cancers are still missed, colon cancer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's not perfect. Again, no test is perfect. As far as polyps are concerned, it's really not good at detecting polyps or large precancerous polyps, unless they're hemorrhagic or they've got mutational changes and they're very mm-hmm. much on the way to becoming cancer.
Mm-hmm.
When I talk to my colleagues about ColoGuard, you know, we agree the best test is the one that gets done. We have a lot of false positive ColoGuards. If you talk to mm-hmm. any gastroenterologist anywhere, they'll say ColoGuard, oh, it's another positive ColoGuard coming through the door. We have to do this urgently. It's negative, and I end up doing what we call a tandem colonoscopy. I'll go in all the way, come mm-hmm. all the way back, talking about in the colon. I'll do a full exam, and then I'll go all the way back in because I'm feeling insecure that I've missed something now because I have a positive.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So it is quite common for the test to be falsely positive. And that to me isn't so scary. It gives a patient a lot of anxiety, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But what scares me more about ColoGuard is false negatives, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
That we never hear about. And there's 3-year recommended interval between ColoGuard tests. 3 years mm-hmm. is a fairly long time. Let's say at year one, you have a negative ColoGuard, but you have a very large polyp that's growing that isn't bleeding mm-hmm. and is not shedding any cancerous DNA. You're complacent. You're like, oh, I've got a negative ColoGuard. I'm totally fine. 3 years later, it's positive. You come have a colonoscopy and you have a cancer.
Mm-hmm.
If you had a colonoscopy at year one, very likely one of us, a gastroenterologist, would have seen this large precancerous polyp, cut it out at its base, and reduced your risk back down to zero. So again, it has its uses. It's a great test. It's very sensitive for colon cancer, but it's going to miss a lot of precancerous polyps.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So I don't know. I think it's good for awareness. I'm happy talking about it because colon awareness is a wonderful thing, regardless. So,
right.
I think we're seeing more of it, but I don't know where it fits in. I think fit testing to me is every year is better. And right. Also, we have to realize who Cologuard's not for, right? Mm. Cologuard is FDA cleared for folks who are average risk. So people mm-hmm. with no family history, people who have no history of colitis, people who are Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, people who personally have no history of polyps themselves. So if you have a past history of polyps and someone's recommending a Cologuard, that's wrong. You need to have a surveillance colonoscopy. You're already at too far increased risk. Cologuard mm-hmm. has not been researched in that population. So just mm-hmm. an FYI. Yeah.
Amazing. Thank you so much for breaking that down. So I always like to think about colon cancer screening and actually lots of things in terms of barriers. You know, what is keeping people from doing the thing that they should do to optimize their health, right? Like, well, they're not exercising because nobody really likes to exercise, or they're not drinking because they enjoy, you know, the feeling they get from alcohol. People are not getting their colonoscopies for a lot of different reasons. You know, sure. One of them is lack of understanding of how important it is, how common colon cancer is, number two cancer killer in yes. this country. They are afraid. They're afraid of the prep. They're afraid of the complications. So you address those so carefully, very, very rare complication rate. Yes. The prep is the prep. You're going to get through it. But another barrier is maybe this idea that there are other things that are just as good, and why should I do this seemingly hard thing? Well, we just address the limitations of those other things. One of the other really big barriers that I would love for you to address is, you know, I just can't get someone on the phone to schedule my test. Like, I hear that all the time. So, you know, Fried, in my practice, yes. I actually have a dedicated person, shout out Lauren Marone.
She's incredible. Yeah.
She sits on the phone and literally schedules people's appointments for them because they just get frustrated with the process. So can you speak to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when you look at community screening rates, there is a huge drop off when there aren't organized drives for colon cancer awareness, for colon cancer screening. And it really comes down to sort of how we approach screening. And that happens at the primary care level, right? We're not seeing patients until they come to us with a problem, typically in the office. Organized pushes at the primary level, like your practice, make an absolutely massive difference. Awareness happens at that point of contact. So I think just having that discussion, normalizing that discussion every time you touch a patient is huge. And you guys do a phenomenal job of that. You have very educated patients coming out of your practice as a result of your providers, you know, educating and talking about this. Just talking about it is enough. Mm-hmm. I think that in terms of access, what people need to understand is that for average risk or even family history of colon cancer folks, you don't need to come see a gastroenterologist for an appointment to talk about it. We have what's called open access screening. So if you decide as someone's primary care doctor, it's time for you to have a colonoscopy, you just click the button and it's not that simple, but Lauren will call, get in touch with our folks, and we'll get that person on the schedule as soon as possible. So it doesn't need to be a cumbersome process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that. So I think for patients listening, you know, what's really inconvenient? Colon cancer. I hate to be glib about it, but it sucks to have to call and leave a message and call your primary and can you help me get this appointment? Or I have to take a day off work. Like, all those inconveniences really don't hold a candle to the inconvenience of, God forbid, getting sick with colon cancer. If you have a great relationship with your primary care doctor, I mean, chances are we have people who listen to this show from all over the country, pockets where access really is terrible, places where people can barely find a primary care doctor, much less a gastroenterologist. But don't let those inconveniences really impact your health. And then in areas where you have a great relationship with your primary care doctor, I'll be the first one to tell you, lean on us, just, put it out there. Just say, I don't want to deal with all of these steps to get to my colonoscopy. Can you please help me? And chances are we've developed relationships with great gastroenterologists like you so that we can facilitate those appointments and really take it off the plate of the patient. So, you know, in the course of this conversation, Frieda, I've heard you say so many important things. The most important is the test that gets done is the best test. Yeah. If you and I had our pick, we would pick the screening colonoscopy for all of the reasons that you said, but there are other options out there. So I would say to patients, if you're absolutely 100% not going to get a colonoscopy, at least let's have the conversation about other things. Yeah. Do you have parting thoughts for us, Frieda? What if you could leave our audience with like one take home, you know, message, like that they're going to like have cemented in their noggin, what would that message be?
I think the take home message would be, this is a completely preventable cancer. And it breaks my heart every time I have to diagnose someone with colon cancer. There are rare exceptions, obviously, in someone who's extremely young with a cancer syndrome, but in the vast majority of the average population, if everybody got screened, which I know is not a reality, there really could be near zero rates of colon cancer. It really is that preventable. There's almost no other cancer that's this preventable.
Wow.
You know, think about skin cancer, for example.
Yeah.
If you look down at your arm and you see a giant mole and it's growing, you're not going to just say, forget it. Most normal folks are like, oh my God, that's a little bit concerning. Let me go to a dermatologist. They're going to slice that off and test it and hopefully prevent skin cancer.
Mm-hmm.
You can't see the lining of your colon. The same thing's happening. You're having the same kind of growths. You know,
wouldn't
you want to have those taken out and get your risk back down to zero. So I guess my take home point is 70% reduction in mortality from colon cancer with colonoscopy, second leading cause of cancer death. Totally doesn't have to be that way. We have the ability and the power in the community to reduce those rates dramatically. We're doing a pretty good job of getting people screened, but we can do even better with awareness. Our goal in our GI societies is to get that rate up to 80% screened in the population. Right now it's 60%. So we have a big gap there that we have to get to. So educating and getting the word out there, understanding the disease process, understanding that it really does impact a lot of people. And that it's, again, it's totally, totally preventable. Yeah.
Oh my God. That is the 100% money message right there. Like it is completely, completely preventable. And we just have to work together to raise awareness and remove some of those barriers. So speaking of, you guys are doing something very special. And, you know, it's so funny. I just asked you about this. You're having a very special event. And I was like, what's the date again? And you told me it's April 4th. And guess what? April 4th is my oldest daughter's birthday. So how do I not remember that date? Like, duh.
Hopefully she's not listening to this podcast.
She 100% is. And I'm going to hear about it at the minute it airs. So tell me about the event on April 4th.
Yeah. So April 4th is our Colon Cancer Awareness Day screening event. It's a week after Colon Cancer Awareness Month, but due to scheduling, we're having it a little late, better late than never.
And, absolutely.
We're co-sponsoring this event with a local cancer foundation, the Robert Grimm Memorial Athletic Foundation, which is a wonderful colon cancer awareness foundation that was born out of the life of Robert Grimm, who was a unfortunate victim of colon cancer a few years back. Wonderful local business leader and champion of junior sports. So this is a wonderful charity foundation that works with local communities and providing colon cancer awareness events at local high schools in Westchester and Downingtown. They provide athletic scholarships, donations for athletic gear. And I had a chance to meet the founder of that, Kim Grimm, the wife, Robert Grimm, who's a wonderful person. And we're very excited to work with them on this event in promoting colon cancer awareness, education. And we're going to be doing screenings all day, exclusively screening colonoscopies. With myself and Dr. Nirav Shah, who's one of my wonderful colleagues. And we look forward to working with this foundation for many events in the future as well. So,
wow. Thank you so much for doing that. So I just want people here, because again, you know, I always think like the only people listening to this podcast are like my husband and about seven people in our community. But obviously, that is not true. There are people listening from all over. I'm so thankful for that. So I want to just put it out there. You know, colon cancer events don't create themselves. They just don't. It takes like somebody to say, like, let's do something. And Fareed, I'm so grateful to you for, you know, having this openness to have this conversation and say, yeah, we're going to do something that's inconvenient, because let's face it, guys, like, doctors are busy and gastroenterologists are busy. And, you know, to take a day and just say, we're going to dedicate an entire day just to screen people is huge. But if you are a patient who's passionate about colon cancer screening because you've lost a loved one, or if you've gone through colon cancer yourself, or you're involved with a charity that wants to raise colon cancer awareness, take it to your community doctors. Just don't be shy about that. Knock on doors, make phone calls, say, hey, can we organize something together? Because that's where the magic really happens, in these little events that reach, you know, however many people. But if we have tons of these events across the country, you know, we're really making an impact. So that's a message I really want to put out there. Like, these events are not going to create themselves. And they're also, they don't have to be this colossal, like, undertaking. You know, it takes a willing gastroenterology practice, right? And I guarantee you they exist in your community. You just have to reach out to them. And it maybe will take some coordinating, you know, like some setup, maybe some, I don't know, some advertising, some whatever the promotion is, but it's not that hard. And we could just reach so many more people. So thank you for making it so obvious for you that it can be done. And just for people listening, we had a colon cancer screening event with Dr. Razavi earlier this year in the fall. So this is actually the second one that we are participating in with in a 12-month period. And we're so grateful for that. I had my first colonoscopy at one of these events, and I had a 4-millimeter polyp myself. In fact, that event was 5 years ago, and I'm embarrassed to say I've yet to schedule my 5-year follow-up. So I'm on that, and you are absolutely not going to be the doctor that does it. Definitely not. You know, no offense. It's just like, we are too close. We're like, yeah, next level now.
I get it.
So Fareed, thank you so much. Knowledge, your openness, your ease of conversation. You know, sometimes I talk to doctors on this podcast and it's like pulling teeth, because some of these conversations are hard. You honestly made it so easy, comfortable. Yeah. Thank you.
Healing's mutual. And it's an easy conversational topic. You know, I find that this is something that if you talk to most gastroenterologists, they're deeply passionate about. I mean, we should be. This is the core of what we do, right? Is preventing cancer. And it's deeply, deeply satisfying to do a colonoscopy on someone who's healthy and young and find a polyp and cut it out and talk to them about it. Like, this is why you came in. It feels validating. I almost feel better when I do that than have a negative colonoscopy. I kind of feel weird when it's negative. I'm like, oh,
yeah.
Had a normal colon. See ya. You know, when we take out a polyp, like, this is why I went into this field. It's so satisfying. So I could talk about it for hours, and obviously appreciate your partnership in everything we do. We can only do what we do based on great PCPs in the community, and you guys are really top tier and key opinion leaders yourself. So it's an honor to work with you, and work on any events in the future. So anytime, happy to talk about it, and I'm happy to help you arrange anything you need to do in the future.
Thank you so much, Fareed. And I know that you're going to inspire lots and lots of other doctors to do the same in their communities. So I appreciate it so much.
Yeah.
For everybody listening, if you are 45 years old and are average risk for colon cancer, meaning you don't have ulcerative colitis or Crohn's and you don't have a family history of colon cancer, you need to schedule your first colonoscopy and at least have a conversation about it start with your primary care doctor, and they would be more than happy to guide you. If you are in our local Southeastern PA region, Chester County specifically, it's Dr. Fareed Razavi. His contact information is going to be in our show notes. You could reach out to their practice. They've been so, so kind and so accommodating. You won't be sorry that you did that. thank you all so much for listening. Once more, Fareed, thank you for being here. This is a topic, again, near and dear to my heart. So if I can answer questions for you, please feel free to leave a comment on the YouTube channel or message me directly, email me directly. We would be happy to help in any way. Thank you all for being here again. This is Dr. Christine Meyer. You've been listening to this episode of Tell Me More.